This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the cost of revealing state secrets in Australia. Federal police raid the ABC and sift through thousands of documents. My guest is ABC News executive editor John Lyons, who's been watching the AFP raid. I'll also speak with lawyer Bernard Collieri, who's facing legal action for his role in revealing quite separate secrets. He says the Prime Minister must act to protect public interest journalism.
He must understand there are higher values involved in being a Prime Minister than simply allowing the black letter laws to be sometimes technically, and other times oppressively enforced.
Our main story ahead. Yes, that is our main story tonight. We begin PM from inside the ABC's headquarters in Sydney, indeed, where the Australian Federal Police are searching for information over a series of 2017 stories detailing abuses by Australia's special forces in Afghanistan. This is the second AFP raid on journalists in 24 hours, coming after yesterday's search of the Canberra home of a News Corp journalist, Annika Smethurst, who had reported separately on secret plans to allow the expansion of government spying on our citizens. An AFP statement says no arrests are planned from today's raids, that the Minister for Home Affairs was not notified prior to the raids, and that the warrant was not linked to a search warrant executed in Canberra yesterday. But experts worry the crackdown heralds a new oppressive climate for journalists. In a moment, I'll be joined by the ABC's head of investigative journalism, John Lyons, who's been in the room with the AFP officers all day today, live tweeting the events. But first, Eleanor Whitehead will bring you up to date.
Australian Federal Police officers walk through the doors of the ABC's Sydney headquarters looking for material linked to a series of 2017 investigations called the Afghan Files. The ABC News director Gavin Morris was named in the search warrant.
Our journalists do a really difficult job. I'm proud of the job they do. They do it in the public's interest. And journalism is not a crime. So I would say to all of the journalists at the ABC and all the journalists across Australia, don't be afraid of the job you do. Stand up and be proud of it and continue to act in the public's interest, knowing that the stories you tell and the service you provide the community is a vital one for our democracy.
The AFP's warrant also named investigative journalists Dan Oakes and Sam Clark, whose 2017 reporting revealed allegations of unlawful killings by Australian special forces in Afghanistan. In a statement, the AFP said the warrant related to allegations of publishing classified material contrary to the provisions of the Crimes Act 1914. Here's the ABC's editorial director, Craig McMurtry.
They are relying on a piece of legislation that was repealed. There was a public interest defence for journalists added. I'm talking about Section 79 of the Crimes Act. But that public interest defence did not apply at the time of the reporting of the Afghan Files 2 years ago.
The warrant was broad and powerful, allowing the AFP to add, copy, delete or alter material on the ABC's computers. Officers have downloaded more than 9,000 items.
It's a very unwelcome and serious development. I think for people maybe who aren't in the media business, sometimes talking about press freedom can sound a bit like a cliché. It is extremely unusual for an authority to exercise a warrant on a national public broadcaster like this.
The raid comes just a day after the AFP searched the Canberra home of News Corp political journalist Annika Smethurst, alleging there had been an unauthorised leak of national security information in a story she wrote in April 2018. 2GB journalist and Sky News presenter Ben Fordham says he's also facing raids after running a story which revealed confidential Home Affairs information. Johan Lidberg is an associate professor of journalism at Monash University. He says a slew of anti-terror and national security laws are strangling the media.
We have seen this coming for quite some time, ever since Australia started raising the level in terms of its shall we say, hyper-legislation agenda around anti-terror and and national security. How much of our liberal freedoms are we prepared to give up in the name of security?
Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton denied that he was involved in the AFP's investigation and said his office was informed of the search warrants after they had been executed. And speaking to RN Breakfast this morning, Attorney General Christian Porter refuted allegations that police were being used to intimidate journalists.
And this is an investigation from the AFP. It is done completely independent of executive government.
Shadow Home Affairs Minister Christina Keneally said in a statement that Labour has requested a briefing on why raids of such nature are warranted. But there has been broad bipartisan support for national security legislation, and Johan Lidberg at Monash University worries this might become a new normal for journalists.
It is an extremely chilling thing. So, yes, it could be potentially a way to put other journalists off reporting these matters. They are enough complicated the way they are with all the 60 plus laws around it. But it's quite conceivable that this is sending a message that, you know, stay out of reporting national security matters, which would be horrible.
Johan Lidberg is an associate professor of journalism at Monash University. Well, sitting alongside the AFP investigators as they've gone through the hard drives and documents at the ABC's headquarters has been the executive editor and head of investigations at ABC News, John Lyons. He's been live tweeting the process all afternoon, but joined me earlier to reflect on the day's events.
It's been a remarkable day, Linda, for the ABC and for the media and for me as well. If someone had said to me this morning, by the time you get home today, you will have live tweeted an AFP raid, I would have thought, you know, how do those things all fit together? But I was able to sit in that room for several hours. I thought we should have at least one journalistic representative in the room. Otherwise, it was just AFP officers and lawyers for the ABC. So I sat in there, and then the media sort of took photos and tweeted a bit. So I thought, why don't I tweet the whole thing? And the AFP sort of knew I was doing it, in the end gave me that sort of basically weren't going to throw me out of the room. And I said, listen, they said, why are you doing this? And I said, well, I think the staff should know what's going on and the public, and, you know, this is a media organisation. This is what we do.
Did they accept that?
They did accept it. And it's been quite a bizarre situation where we've been sitting in the room for hours, and every so often, you know, they'll sort of, I think, show each other a particular tweet that I've sent out. But the more disturbing side of it is that I've just walked out of that room to do this interview. Right now, they've 9,214 emails and pieces of correspondence and scripts of TV scripts, etc., have been downloaded. They're now going through all of those with ABC lawyers and essentially saying, we want that, we don't want that, that's okay, that's not relevant, we want that one. And I think it's a complete and utter violation of what a free media is.
I mean, they're getting to see all sorts of stuff that has nothing to do with the warrant, presumably.
That's right. I mean, there's been emails in there, you know, mentioning Bill Shorten or Dennis Richardson, or, you know, completely unrelated. And the AFP is standing there, six of them, seeing all of this material. This couldn't happen in the United States. I just think Australians have to realise that in the US, with their constitutional protections, the FBI could not go into National Public Radio or the New York Times and essentially get into their computer system. And the power of this warrant is the most savage I've ever seen. It gives them the power, for example, to delete or to add to any ABC document that they see fit.
I was going to ask you about that. I saw you tweet that, and I know a lot of other people have picked that up as well. That sounds like they can manipulate evidence. Is that your interpretation?
Well, it means that they are able to go in there and delete the originals of any ABC correspondence. So I'm wondering, what are the political leaders? You know, what's, you know, the ABC chair, Ida Buttrose and people? I mean, what's going to be our response? Because what's going on at the moment on the 11th floor of this building where I'm sitting, I think is an outrage against the media.
Are they getting the kind of information that might imperil sources in this story, the Afghanistan story?
Well, they're trying to. I won't name the person or the individuals that they're clearly after, but after several hours locked in a room with them, it's clear to me who their targets are, and it's not just the journalists involved who we can name. They're on the warrants, Dan Oakes and Sam Clark in Melbourne and the Director of News, Gavin Morris, but they're in fact targeting the people who they think gave them that information, and they're hoping that from these 9,214 documents that they will find that and essentially build a case against this person.
Will they find it?
Well, they're certainly now locked. They're standing in front of a big screen. Let me just describe the scene. It's the 11th floor of the ABC building. It's a fairly bland room. You have three digital forensic experts from the Australian Federal Police and three senior detective sergeants, officers. You have a team of ABC lawyers, and they're standing there. And it's an absolutely extraordinary process where I just tweeted before, the conversation went something like this. No, not that one. Nut media, defence media, not interested. Next one. Oh, Nick McKenzie, no, from The Age. Different story. Move on. Can you go up a bit? And they sort of then scrolling up to have a look at what's at the end of an email. And then no use. Yep, that one's relevant. And then the ABC lawyers will say, well, hold on, that's not relevant. And at one point, the AFP said, we want any document between in those 2 or 3 year periods that's marked secret. And the ABC lawyers actually pushed back, which was good. And they said, hold on, you can't just claim any document that has the word secret on it is part of your purview under this warrant. But I think it's a complete violation of a free media.
The Prime Minister has said that he believes, Australia believes strongly in the freedom of the press. We have clear rules and protections for freedom of the press, he said. Is that true? Does this give us evidence to suggest that it's not true?
Well, if this is freedom of the press, I'd like to see, you know, the opposite. In the last 24 hours, the AFP have raided the home of Annika Smethurst, a very good and honest journalist for News Corporation. They've spent 7 hours going through her kitchen and bedroom and the whole house because of a story she wrote warning that the intelligence services wanted to increase their powers. What an irony that is. They then contacted Ben Fordham at 2GB Radio, afternoons presenter, the Home Affairs Department, and pressured him to reveal a source. He's refused to do so, and now they're raiding the ABC.
Yeah, can I just jump in there? Because the AFP in their latest statement just a short time ago have said there is no connection between these things. They've also said we did not notify the Home Affairs Minister before this raid today. Do you accept that there is no political agenda here?
Look, the stories that they've raided on are separate, but the connection, I'm afraid, is they're both AFP raids. There's two AFP raids on the media in the space of 24 hours. To me, that's a connection.
And so what happens now? Is the raid ongoing?
What happens now is the ABC, by the way, has not handed over these documents yet. What's going on is there's this sort of horse trading and haggling. The ABC's reserved its rights to seek an injunction against handing over this material. There will probably be a 2-week delay during which the ABC will make a decision as to whether it actually hands over these documents or not. Once the AFP has said the ones they want, if you like, there's a bit of a cooling off period. The ABC might actually say we don't want to hand over any of them.
John Lyons is Executive Editor and Head of Investigations at ABC News, now back tweeting with the AFP investigators alongside him. Bernard Collieri is an Australian lawyer. He is facing prosecution along with a whistleblower known only as Witness K for their roles in revealing that Australia had covertly bugged the East Timor government during sensitive oil and gas negotiations in 2004. Tiny East Timor was appalled that Australia was secretly trying to get the upper hand in the negotiations to effectively get more money out of the natural resources that East Timor claims. As with the raids today and yesterday over examples of investigative journalism in the public interest involving leaks, the Collieri Witness K case has raised questions about state overreach and silencing revelations of matters in the public interest. I spoke to Bernard Collieri earlier.
This experience occurred to the United States in the 50s and 60s, when the Reds Under the Bed hunt was on. The legislature had given extra powers to the FBI, and those powers just took off. And if Mr. Morrison is saying that he has no control over the issues because the executive don't control it, then you've got the same circumstance that arose in the 50s and early 60s in the United States of America. Those recent amendments to the Commonwealth Criminal Code, if you look at the amendments slipped through in the Foreign Interference Bill, you'll see how vulnerable journalists, particularly journalists, who speak to sources outside legal professional privilege are, and indeed lawyers are now in our country.
The Prime Minister has said Australia believes strongly in the freedom of the press and has clear rules and protections for freedom of the press. He also said he has no trouble with the law being enforced. Can we trust and believe those statements in the current circumstances,
well,
do you think?
There is no concept of a Prime Minister abdicating control over state agencies such as the AFP. The Prime Minister has to be exemplary. He must understand there are higher values involved in being a Prime Minister than simply allowing the black letter laws to be sometimes technically, and other times oppressively enforced. The foreign interference legislation involved a great deal of breastbeating by both major parties, but it was the major parties that had been involved in very, very close liaison with sovereign powers themselves affecting vast economic issues affecting Australia. No investigations there, next to no inquiries. And now there are to be, according to Mr. Morrison, a hands-off approach.
So are you saying that the Prime Minister should step in these cases and protect the public interest journalism that's at stake in the matters involving Annika Smethurst and now the ABC?
There's a very well-known aphorism: publicity is the soul of justice. Now, if there's an allegation, and I don't know much about this Smethurst matter, but if there's an allegation of executive misconduct, then the matter is in the Prime Ministerial hands. He has to be exemplary. If there is to be a report of executive misconduct that does not affect Australia's national security, that is, he has to weigh those values, become involved and decide whether imposing burdens on the media in the way that the current raids impose to try and keep the media non-reportive of executive misconduct is a failure of governance. It's a failure, a core failure of a Prime Minister who must set and defend the rule of law. And the rule of law involves far greater issues than technicalities. It involves balancing all of the issues of civil liberties in our country. And as the former Human Rights Commissioner Gillian Trigg said, Australia is now the least observant and the most repressive of the Western democracies. And the Prime Minister has to explain the raids. He has to not say, well, you know, the police have got a role to play and it's very important that no one speaks about what goes on behind closed doors. But the reality is the Prime Minister should state very clearly what's at stake for Australians in stopping journalists from reporting alleged misconduct, executive misconduct.
Bernard Collaery, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Lawyer Bernard Collaery. You're listening to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, economists warn the latest growth figures reveal the economy is sick. So what does that mean for you? Another very big legal matter playing out today in Victoria's Court of Appeal, where George Pell's legal team has been putting the case for their client to be acquitted and set free. They say it was unreasonable for the jury last December to find him guilty beyond reasonable doubt based on the evidence presented to them. Australia's most senior Catholic was convicted on 5 counts of sexually abusing 2 choir boys at Melbourne's St Patrick's Cathedral in the 1990s. Samantha Donovan has been at court today and has been outlining the main argument that Pell's lawyers have been putting to the judges.
Well, Linda, it's this first round of the appeal, and this is the one that Cardinal Pell and his lawyers are really hoping will succeed, because it will result in him being acquitted and set free. And the argument essentially is that it was unreasonable for the jury to reach the guilty verdict. They say that it's just not possible that the juries could have had no doubt about his guilt, because the case in favour of convicting him was based solely on the evidence of one person, and that that was the complainant, whereas they point to about 20 witnesses who gave evidence that Pearl's abuse of the boys either didn't happen or couldn't have happened. And those witnesses were people at St Patrick's Cathedral at that time, back in 96 and 97, people like church officials and choristers and parents. Pearl's lawyers have argued that the then Archbishop had an alibi, that he was standing at the cathedral door speaking to worshippers at the time the alleged offending occurred. They say that it wasn't possible for the offending to have happened in the 5 to 6 minute time frame that it's claimed it happened, that it's not possible that no one saw the offending given the number of people around at the time, and also that Pearl's robes made it impossible that he could abuse the boys in the way that it's been claimed. Now, the appeal court judges have done a lot of work ahead of today's hearing. They've read all the trial evidence, they've listened to the recordings, they've been through all the submissions for the appeal. They've even looked at the type of robes Pearl would have been wearing as Archbishop back then, and they've been to St Patrick's Cathedral to see the rooms where the offences are said to have happened. So today we heard the judges asking Pearl's lawyers questions about all these arguments. It was a very detailed legal argument with plenty of references to case law and precedent. There were questions of logic and semantics. They asked questions about the robes, for example, and the brazenness of the offending, which Pearl's lawyers point to as evidence that it just didn't happen.
Now, there are other grounds as well for this appeal. They're sort of more technical, aren't they? Can you explain them?
Yes, so if he isn't acquitted on that first ground, Pearl's lawyers are relying on a second ground, that the trial judge was wrong in not allowing them to play a visual aid in their closing argument. Now, this was described at the trial as being like the old Pac-Man computer game, showing the movement of people in the cathedral in support of that argument that there were just too many people around for the offences to have been carried out. Barrister Ruth Shan told the appeal court judge today that this is 21st century technology that should be permitted in a 21st century case, because she said jurors are so addicted to phones and tablets, they need that visual representation of what may have happened. She said that the prosecution's case was that there were just three people around at the time of the offending, but she said this visual aid would have helped the jury see that there were at least 10 other people at the back of the cathedral area at that time, and that their evidence should be disregarded. The final ground, Linda, is a very technical point relating to how many of the jurors were in the room when Pearl was arraigned, that is, when he entered his plea of not guilty. Now, if either of those two grounds are accepted by the Court of Appeal, it's most likely a retrial will be ordered.
Our reporter Samantha Donovan. The Northern Territory's Chief Minister has today ordered an immediate review of everyone who's on parole and being monitored after last night's shooting rampage that left four dead in Darwin. Among the victims now being identified is a local taxi driver described as much loved. The identity of the alleged gunman has also become public. Police say he was on parole and wearing an electronic monitoring bracelet at the time of the attacks. Experts say, though, that this case is an outlier. Amelia Turzon reports from Darwin.
Police say the alleged gunman, 45-year-old Benjamin Glenn Hoffman, had been on parole in the Northern Territory since January. In response, the Northern Territory Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, says there'll be an urgent review into the Territory's parole system.
Police will have an independent review of the incident and details will be advised later. This work will be thorough.
Professor of Criminal Law and Justice at the University of South Australia, Rick Saar.
We can make a fairly safe assumption that parole is usually a safe exercise. Every now and again something goes terribly awry, as it did in this case. Yes, it's an easy criticism of the parole system to say that surely we should be locking more people up for longer. But one, that costs an enormous amount of money, and every dollar you spend in keeping people behind bars are dollars you're not spending on rehabilitation, on housing, on education, on employment, on drug treatment, etc. So it's a balance.
Professor Saar says while the system works most of the time, he welcomes the review.
Look, I think that's a good thing. Victoria went through this a couple of years ago when they had someone who was on parole who engaged in a violent activity that led to the death of another person. And what that review came up with was a very sensible number of recommendations, including greater resourcing for the parole board, a review of the horrendous caseloads of correctional staff who were dealing with non-custodial parolees, better information sharing between police and mental health authorities, for example.
The alleged offender was also wearing an electronic bracelet, and questions have been raised over why it took an hour for Territory Police to find him. The monitoring devices are worn by parolees so they can be tracked by the authorities. If they go somewhere they shouldn't or stay out beyond their curfew, then the system is meant to trigger an alarm. Professor Saar says electronic monitors have their limits.
It would just be simply impossible to say, well, we've got 10,000 bracelets out there on a 24-hour basis. You've got someone glued to a screen to see where those 10,000 people are going. That is simply impossible.
Marietta Martinovic is a senior lecturer in criminology and justice at RMIT University who studies the effectiveness of the electronic bracelets.
In the past, they didn't have that condition. They were roaming around free and nobody knew where they were.
But she says even electronic monitoring can't stop wrongdoing.
If somebody is not in the or approaching their exclusion zone, they don't come to be alerted by the alert of the authorities necessarily, because nobody's there at the back looking through these moving dots and thinking, oh, what are they doing? Because you've got no idea of knowing what people are doing. You can only see where they are.
There are currently 103 people on parole in the Northern Territory. 46 are on active monitoring, and the review is set to be completed by the end of next week.
Amelia Turzon reporting. Well, some economic growth figures out today. The latest check on the health of the national economy, and it shows it's getting harder to land a job or ask for more hours or bargain for more pay. Bureau of Statistics figures show the economy grew at just 1.8% in the year to March, the slowest pace since the global financial crisis. Economists say what's keeping the economy afloat are government spending on infrastructure and welfare initiatives like the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Outside of that, economists warn the Australian economy is sick. Business reporter David Taylor has more.
It's the weakest economic growth in almost a decade. National Australia Bank Chief Economist Alan Oster.
If you're in the private sector, it's really not doing much at all.
In the 3 months to March, the Australian economy grew by just 0.4 percentage points, or 1.8% over the year. The last time the economy moved that slowly was in the wake of the biggest hit to the global economy since the Great Depression. Consumers and shoppers are supposed to be driving growth, but official figures show they're not, holding back on anything they don't absolutely need, like a cafe lunch or buying that latest must-have fashion accessory.
What it's really saying is the private sector is still very, well, sick.
Consumers are less than enthusiastic about spending for a number of reasons. Wages aren't budging, the cost of living is high, and households are worried about the value of their homes and paying off debt. The Reserve Bank, in dropping interest rates, is doing its best to lighten the load for households. But as the bank's governor, Philip Lowe, pointed out in a speech last night, it's going to need some help pushing the economy forward. Alan Oster.
What we saw with the Reserve Bank governor was also saying, hey, Canberra, please help. Do some infrastructure, do some structural reform, because we can't just do everything with monetary policy. And I think he's right.
But Joe Masters, the chief economist of global accounting firm EY, says there's actually a limit to how much the government can help the economy without creating more problems.
Whenever you put the budget into deficit, what you're really doing is borrowing growth from the future. So when the budget's in deficit, we use debt to pay for that, and future generations will need to pay that debt off.
By higher taxes, I assume.
By higher taxes, absolutely.
The fate of the Australian economy now rests on how many job seekers can find work and what they do with the money they earn. Developing policy to assist that is therefore crucial. But there's a yawning gap between the government's perception of how hard it is to land a job and how private sector economists view the job hunt. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
The strong labour market has drawn more people into work, particularly women and seniors, and the participation rate at 65.8% is now at a record high. And the strong labour market is one of the reasons why the fundamentals of the Australian economy remain sound.
Alan Oster.
I think basically the labour market is going to weaken as we go forward, because as the economy slows, it takes time and the growth of employment of 3% or 2.5% or whatever it was in the last 12 months is going to go closer to 1%. So it's going to get weaker as we go forward.
Without more jobs growth, EY's Joe Masters warns it's going to get harder to pay the bills.
So when we have slow economic growth, it's very hard to get wage increases, even if your job is secure. So that means from an income point of view, when you're facing a big mortgage because of housing affordability, when the cost of living is going up, those things get tougher if you can't generate wage increase.
Another big pillar holding up the economy is the export sector, as China sucks up huge amounts of Australia's iron ore. So the latest World Bank downgrade to global economic growth is unnerving. The bank warns that risks are skewed, quote, firmly to the downside, blaming trade tensions between the world's two biggest economies, the US and China.
Business reporter David Taylor, and that's PM. If you like podcasts, PM is a podcast. We are also on the ABC Listen app, and you can find our webpage, search ABC PM. Sabra Lane is along in the morning with AM, and Eleanor Hall brings you the world today at lunchtime. I'm Linda Mottram. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow, but enjoy the radio ahead tonight with updates from ABC News. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.